So if you can find a niche where somebody has a site that's only a year old and they're already doing well in that space, that's potentially a low competition niche, right? So that is one thing that I would look for. But even if you check that box, you need to have some sort of passion or interest, because you're going to be in this space for a long time, you know, multiple years.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the SEO Entrepreneur Show. I am very, very excited today to have Spencer Haas on the show. And I've been following Spencer. Man, I can't even remember when I first found Spencer. It must have been 2013-ish, in that range. I mean, I've been following him for a very long time and love the work that he does. He has a massive amount of experience, not just in the SEO space, but selling products, building FBA businesses. Like, he's got the whole gauntlet of things. So we're going to dive into each of these things. But regardless, thank you so much for coming on, Spencer.
Yeah, Nathan, it's a pleasure to come on. Always happy to chat SEO or business or just anything entrepreneurial. So super excited to be on the show and share some of my experiences.
For sure. So for the people that maybe don't know your background, how did you discover SEO?
Oh, man. So I was in business banking before I discovered this whole world of SEO. And so I was in the corporate world and started just dabbling, seeing if I could even build a website. Okay. I've always had sort of business ideas. And one of these led me to, hey, let's see if I can even create a website. What does that involve? My first website that I created was back in 2006. And I created a website in the, you know, kind of like a financial blog, because I was in banking, you know, in finance. That's what I graduated in. And so created a website and quickly got no traffic and decided, you know what, let's do some more research here. And that led me down the path of, oh, how do you rank in Google when somebody types something in? How do they find your website and your blog? So it was, 2007, 2008 is kind of when I figured out, oh, SEO is a thing. And then it wasn't until 2011 that I finally got good enough at it that I had built a bunch of websites by this point and was able to quit my full-time job as a business banker in 2011. And I've been doing SEO, building websites, internet businesses ever since.
Wow. Yeah. So let's touch on the fact of how much SEO has changed since 2007 to today. How much has that shifted?
Oh, man. A ton, obviously. I mean, there's, you know, I don't know how many updates, right? Hundreds, maybe, that we could look at. But the SEO landscape has changed a ton. I mean, back then, people were doing all sorts of spun content and all sorts of, not just PBNs, but all sorts of link schemes that, like, I wouldn't even, you know, attempt at this point. So it's changed dramatically, going from like, okay, I could rank on the first page with like just an exact match domain and one article that was like 500 words long and a couple of like spammy backlinks, to like where we are now, which is like, you gotta have quality. Anyways, we can go into link building strategies and all that, but changed, it's night and day between where it was, however many years ago that was.
Yeah. And I'm sure even one thing that's definitely changed is even how you would probably even select a niche. Like, I'm sure you'd probably second guess going into the financial sector at this point, I would imagine. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot more difficult for sure. That's probably not where I would start unless you just know, hey, I'm going to be in this for 3, 4, 5 years before I really start seeing results. And if you're in for that long haul, then yeah, maybe you can jump into a difficult niche, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And so those early niche sites that you were building, so how were those monetized? Were they through affiliate display?
Yeah, mostly Google AdSense early on. My first sort of batch of niche sites is, like I said, I'd be building exact match domains, just try to rank quickly on the first page of Google, monetized with Google AdSense, then moved into Amazon affiliate shortly after that, right? So mostly Amazon affiliate, display ads, and trying to think of, you know, probably some affiliate offers outside of that as well. I was doing that probably up through like 2012 when like Panda and Penguin update came, and that really changed the landscape for me and shifted you know, so 2013, 2014, really started focusing on more quality, building true websites that are valuable, kind of got rid of all the stuff that maybe at this point would be called link schemes. Anyway, so have shifted, you know, for the last 10 years.
Right. Yeah. So I want to get into the different forms of monetization that you've obviously added to your repertoire, but I do want to mention, you know, focus on one thing that you're clearly very good at, which is niche selection. So obviously the way that you would pick niches back then is very different than today. So let's talk about today. How, what does your process look like for selecting a niche or showing people how to select a niche?
Yeah. So somebody that's going to pick a niche, I mean, I do think that they need to have some sort of interest in that particular niche. There are lots of niches that you might consider low competition. And that's sort of my second thing is I would look for a niche where either newer sites or lower competition keywords are plentiful, right? So if you can find a niche where somebody has a site that's only a year old and they're already doing well in that space, that's potentially a low competition niche, right? So that is one thing that I would look for. But even if you check that box, you need to have some sort of passion or interest because you're going to be in this space for a long time, you know, multiple years. And so just being interested is a big part of that. And then the third thing that I tell people to look at is, can you actually make money in this space, right? Can you monetize it? Are there good affiliate offers? Could you create your own product, right? That might be a nice, you know, big check mark if eventually down the road you can create your own product. Just looking at other competitors and are they actually making enough money that it interests you. And everybody has a different level, right? That might be only $500 a month if you can get your site making $500 a month. For other people, that might be millions of dollars. I don't know, right? And anywhere in between, right? And so find a niche that is making enough money to satisfy your goal level.
Right. Yeah. And I think I don't know if you've made the same mistake, but I've made this mistake before where I find a niche and like, wow, look at all this beautiful search volume. There's so much opportunity here. And then I create a site and it's just, I rank for everything, but I make very little money. How do you prevent that from happening? To the best of your ability.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of data available about how much money advertisers are spending in any particular niche, right? I think eMarketer and probably Adweek and other companies will show here's the different niches that are spending tons of money on advertising. And that's a nice place to start to see that, oh, there's, you know, X niche spends way much more money than Y niche. And so this is probably more profitable, right? And then you can also do research on individual websites, depending on what it is. You might even look at it, sites sold, right? You can do a lot of research to figure out, oh, they're in the dog niche. And even though it's competitive, their website sold for $1 million. They were making $50,000 a month. And half of that was coming from display ads and half of that was coming from affiliate revenue. So there's actually a lot of data that you can mine with sites that are being sold or have been sold. So I would encourage people to just do a lot of research about, yeah, specific niches that have either sold or how much money advertisers are spending. Or you can look at the individual affiliate offers and go, okay, you know, this company is paying $10 per lead or, you know, $100 per lead. And you can do a lot of back of the napkin math based on that data.
Right. So you can pull some CPC data, I would imagine, too, as a part of the equation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. You can see, CPC data and, you know, kind of marry it with that other data. The industry is spending, you know, way more than this other industry. They have high CPCs. Right. These are the affiliate payouts and can get a good idea.
Right. And then as far as finding like websites that have already sold in that vertical, are you going to be looking at like Empire Flippers or Flippa or those types of sites?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Empire Flippers, Flippa, Quiet Light Brokerage, FE International, Motion Invest. And there's a few others that you can kind of do some data mining, and a lot of people share their success stories, right? I've been surprised sometimes. You can Google like specific things, like dog website that was sold, success story or something. Like, look for these success stories, and founders come on podcasts and share, you know, their whole business model with you. And you can kind of get a great idea of if it's a good niche to go into or not.
Right. So rewinding the clock. So did you, your first batch of sites, were you able to sell any of those first batch, or were they basically, they got hit by the penalty and then you had to just let them go? Or what did that kind of look like?
I did sell some of my early sites, not for a lot. A lot of them, like you said, were just sites that I let go. Others I did sell for nothing more than, I'm trying to think if I even had a, I had a couple, you know, low five figure, you know, sort of sites that I sold early on, call it before 2014. Right. But for the most part, I kind of let those sites go.
Right. So when you were going through this process of like basically building your portfolio of sites, at what point did you say, okay, now it's time to add another vehicle for monetization? And kind of how did you end up with Longtail Pro? Was that the first kind of product that you created, or was there other stuff in between there?
Yeah. Longtail Pro was the first product I created, the first software product. And that was early on. That was 2011. I actually knew that I needed to diversify my portfolio before I quit my full-time job, right? My niche sites were making more than my full-time job in early 2011, end of 2010, right? But I had already made that decision. I needed to diversify, even though I've got, you know, a bunch of niche sites. I've always looked at it like, you're not diversified with multiple sites. I had one traffic source, that's Google. Mm-hmm. And I've always looked at it that way, right? Like, just because you have a bunch of sites doesn't mean you're diversified. If right. Anyways, so before I even quit my job, I hired somebody and built Longtail Pro. And that's sort of what made me comfortable to quit my job, is like, okay, I'm making more than my day job, and I've got this software product that I think is going to do well. I'm going to quit my job. And luckily, you know, Longtail Pro did well. And so ever since 2011, I've built software products, right? Longtail Pro, Table Labs, AMZ Image, maybe another word. There is another WordPress plugin in there somewhere. And then recently, my current projects right now are Link Whisper and Rank Logic is another WordPress plugin. And so have always felt the need to have my own product to sort of supplement what's going on with my SEO businesses as well.
Right. So is that because you don't feel confident in the niche site's portfolio on its own? Or is that because, I mean, what, why? That's, I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to get. 'Cause like, if, could you go all in on just building a portfolio, or do you believe that there's just too much risk when you're isolated on just one traffic channel? Like, for example, if you had, let's say you had five niche sites and maybe 50% of the traffic on those sites was Google and maybe Pinterest is the other half or something, like, would that help decrease the risk?
For sure. Yeah. That would help. I just have always taken an all of the above approach, right? I like to play things as safe as possible. Yes, you could go all in, you know, on sort of a niche site portfolio, and that's fine. I've taken the approach of really going all in on the Niche Pursuits brand, right? And that's done really well SEO wise. But I also have a podcast. I also have you know, software products. I have a large email list. I'm active on social media, right? And so I would just recommend people do that, right? Like, if you're going to go all in on a site or two, like, just do all of the above, right? Create things that make sense for your brand to grow it as much as possible. And so when I look at my brand, it's like, well, it would do better if I could sell my own products, right? And so that's what I've done since day one. I know people that, you know, that's all they do is try to get essentially SEO traffic, and they build a portfolio of sites, and that can work really well. I don't have the appetite for that kind of risk, right? I'd rather just have more going on than just traffic from Google.
Right. So as far as you advising people, based on that, would it be more wise to really focus in on just one site, really focus on building a brand and just kind of extend that out over the long term, as opposed to like, I'm going to create 10 sites over the next 10 weeks. I personally don't think I could do that. It's too stressful. And I know, especially with Niche Pursuits, I've seen the work you've put in on your brand, and it is not easy. It is a lot just to build one brand, let alone 10. So what's your advice on that front?
Yeah, 100%. Go all in on one site and focus on it for 5 years, right? Yeah. Or whatever. Like that's the way to do it. That's the way to build a real business, a big business. You know, SEO traffic can be the first thing, you know, that you tackle, right? It's start that from day one. Absolutely. And even with my brand, like SEO traffic is the largest source of traffic on Niche Pursuits, right? But yeah, no, I stopped trying to do like a huge portfolio, you know, call it 7-8 years ago, right? That was fun in the first, you know, 5 or 6 years of my business, 2011 to 2015, right? But ever since then, I've really been honing in on fewer websites. I do have more than just Niche Pursuits. I do have a couple other what I would call niche sites, right, as well. But I would definitely advise people to go the one site versus, you know, 10 sites or 5 sites or whatever.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's just so difficult. Just one brand. It's so hard. So it's funny because even when I was similar time around when you were doing it, 2011, 2012, like it was so easy to rank back then that because it was so easy, it almost incentivized people like myself and maybe you to just create a lot of sites because it's like, why not? Like it's so easy. You know, you could rank in 30 days, basically. So those days are gone. So
it was a very different approach. Like I said, the model early on was like, get the exact match domain for this one keyword, put up one article, build a few links, and then move to the next site. Right. And then you'd rank, you know, page one. But that ended, you know, a long time ago, obviously. And Google has, you know, kudos to them, I guess. You know, they've done a good job of forcing everybody to up their game, and they wanted quality. And by gosh, you know, we all have to produce quality content now, right? So instead of these 500 word articles, like 3,000, 4,000 word articles sometimes, right, that have lots of imagery and sometimes original data, right? Like it can be a very involved process, and Google has sort of forced that to happen. And so it's just not possible to do that across a whole portfolio of sites.
Right. So going back to Longtail Pro, and you've created a lot of software products. So where do these ideas come from? Is it just because you're in the field and you see opportunity? You're like, okay, I think maybe I could make this a more efficient part of our process using software. Is that kind of the way that it goes? Or where do these ideas stem from, and kind of what does that process look like?
Yeah. So I've always come up with my software ideas out of my own need. So you know, building websites and researching niches and doing keyword research. That's where Longtail Pro came. Is I was in the trenches actually building these sites, doing tons of keyword research. Back in the day, I was using Market Samurai and whatever else was, you know, the Google keyword tool, you know, using those things, and just thought, you know, there has got to be a faster and easier way to do all of this. And I was involved in like the Warrior Forum, Digital Point forums, other places where I could chat with people and like, yeah, you know, it'd be great if there was a better way to do keyword research. And so I, you know, put my ideas down on paper, ended up hiring a developer because I'm not a developer, and built Longtail Pro. And fortunately, a lot of other people had the same problems that I had in my own businesses. And bought the tool. And that's been true of every software tool that I've come up with. Is it's all the best ideas for those listening that maybe want to come up with a software idea. The best ideas always come if you are in the trenches doing the dirty work, because from the surface, you know, if you're not involved in that industry, you might not really know what the problems are. But if you are experiencing those problems and experiencing the pain on your own, you can better understand how to alleviate that pain with your idea. And so I've done the same thing with Link Whisper. You know, I had the pain of building internal links, doing it manually, and trying to figure out how many internal links does this article already have? I don't know. And so I built Link Whisper to make internal linking faster, easier, give full reporting, make it, you know, super easy to use. And people have had the same problem and enjoyed that product as well.
Right. Yeah. So when you're developing a SaaS product, are you going the traditional like MVP route, or are you trying to develop all the, like trying to get to that almost finished product and launching? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, it's more of an MVP approach. I definitely don't build it with its full feature set. Depending on who you talk to, like some MVPs are truly like this thing barely does anything approach, right, and see if people will pay money, like almost landing page, and see if they'll just buy it. I don't go that approach. I have a working product that solves enough pain, right, that people, I feel comfortable like charging people for it. But certainly, you know, if Link Whisper has, you know, sort of 10 core features, right, like I probably launched with three, right, okay, of those, and the most important three, right, and so yeah, we've probably built on, you know, another seven, you know, big features since I've launched it 4 years ago. But I think that's important because it also limits your exposure, right? It's also a risk approach, right? Instead of spending 100% of your budget right up front before you even know if people are interested, right? You can kind of spend 33% of your budget on three features and see if people are interested enough and go, oh, they are. Let's invest, you know, more money.
So when you're trying to map out the features, like, are you the one that's coming up with those new features, or is it like you working with the developer and the developer's like, hey, maybe we should add this? Like, how does that, what does that kind of iterative process look like?
It almost never comes from the developers, okay, because they're not in the SEO space, right? Like they don't, yeah, understand the full problem. So primarily it's coming from me, for the most part. And because I do use, like Link Whisper, for example, I do use it all the time on my site, I still am coming up with, there's still a little bit of pain here. What if we added this feature, right? And so I do that a lot. The other part is feedback from users. We get a lot of feedback, either just customer support tickets or people that I reach out to, or people that, you know, just reach out to me for whatever reason, and kind of say, hey, have you ever thought about doing this? And a lot of that comes with like supporting different themes or plugins, right? Like making sure that Link Whisper works with Elementor and Thrive Architect and Divi Theme and, right, Beaver Builder, right? Like there's a lot of these themes out here that are more obscure. And then if I get five people to email me and say, hey, we're all using Beaver Builder, can you make it work? It's like, oh yeah, we'll make that integration work. So there's a continuous feedback loop with customers as well as they use it.
Right. So when you're, what is the kind of like product launch model look like for you? So are you launching just to a beta group and keeping it super limited, and then having maybe like a, I don't want to say a discounted price, but a lower price, mm-hmm, than what your end goal is of that price? Like, what does that look like when you're doing your, yeah, launch?
Yeah. So the process that I follow is, of course, okay, first, I guess before the launch, I actually did a lot of calls or emails with potential customers, okay, sort of saying, here's what I'm thinking of building. Is that interesting? Right. And, that provided a lot of feedback and direction in the development, itself. But then I then go to some of those same people and then also some more people, right? Call it maybe 50 people and say, hey, are you willing to be a beta tester of this product? I finally got it built. You provided some feedback. Would you test it? And I give them all a free license, right? I give them lifetime free license, like no problem. And so I let them test it, get a bunch of feedback for a month or two, right? We had the features that maybe missed or bug fixes that were there. And then I go to an official, I guess, launch. For me, that's emailing my email list, right? And definitely it's discounted, you know, it's a lower price. And I tell them that. That's part of the launch thing is like, hey, I plan on launching this, you know, in a month, you know, publicly at X price, but you're going to get it for X minus $20 because, you know, you're the first group. And so I'll email my list to launch and kind of, yeah, get some feedback there. And then the final phase, I guess, of the launch is then I reach out to other bloggers, other influencers after I've done a bunch of the updates, right? And like, hey, we've got a great working product. Then I reach out to potential affiliates and go, okay, you know, in 2 weeks, we're going to launch this thing publicly, you know, where you can mention it to your email list. And maybe I'll go and do some podcasts or release some YouTube videos or do other things that are more public so that people can buy it. So that's kind of my phased launch approach.
Right. So for the I'm interested in the initial beta group. What's the rationale for giving to them for free versus having them actually, you know, put some skin in the game? Like, is there a reason for that? Because the only reason I'm asking is because I've noticed there's a direct correlation between people that invest money and usually the likelihood that they're going to use whatever product you're giving them. So like in the case of my training, like when I increased the investment, the engagement increased. So right. I'm just interested to see kind of what your rationale is on that front.
Yeah. Yeah. For the beta group, because I'm most interested in feedback from them and less interested in money. I'm more interested in creating a great product. And so part of the reason that I do that specifically with software is because I know 100% that there's going to be a lot of bugs. There just is. And I don't feel super great about charging people money when I know there's going to be a ton of bugs, right? Because when there's call it sort of an alpha period where me and a couple other people, we test it and maybe everything works great for us. But when you get 50 people that are on, like I said, a dozen different themes, have hundreds of different plugin configurations and just have, you know, different working environments, I just know that there's going to be lots and lots of bugs. And so that's why I don't charge for that beta period is because I want, yeah, just a bunch of people to test it out, work it out. And then once I feel like, okay, I've covered those bases, it's almost like when I launch it to my own list, that's kind of like the paid beta period. It's still like a beta, but then I'm charging.
Right.
And get even more feedback at that point.
Sure. So after the initial beta launch, how I'm assuming like you've collected a lot of intel, which then you can go back to your developer and refine the product and iterate on the product. So like how long is that period after you've basically gotten that large influx of feedback, which could be all over the map and you have to try to decipher what's important, what's not important? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. So the period of like, okay, we get the sort of beta feedback from the early customers to like when I launch it with a paid price tag on it, you know, a month or two.
Okay.
Is so probably moving fast. What it is. Yeah, yeah, move pretty quick because usually when I launch it to the beta, like I said, I've been testing it for 6 or 8 months, you know, or however long. And then, yeah, usually there's some minor things that come up. There will be bugs, right? But they're usually pretty minor that we can fix in a month or two and then turn around and, yeah, release it publicly.
Yeah, so you're probably, you basically want to handle all the big stuff, make sure that's squared away, but you just accept that all the little micro issues are just going to, that's just the nature of the game, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. There's always going to be things that pop up that you just couldn't test or didn't think about.
Right. So obviously you have a huge advantage when you launch a software product or any product, because you have an audience, right? So can you talk about how important that's been for being your growth mechanism for anything that you launch, like that process of building an audience, like how important has that been for your business?
Yeah, that's critical for sure. I you know, Link Whisper and now Rank Logic would not be nearly as successful as they are without my audience, right? And that's something that I would advise anybody is try and build your audience from day one. Email list, YouTube subscribers, social media following, you know, whatever that is. If you have a mechanism where you can communicate with them directly, that's bigger than, you know, SEO even, right? Because people might Google something and come to your website, but you can't communicate with them. They just read, you know, your article and they leave. But if they're on your email list, right, and you have 50,000 people on an email list, you say, hey, I got a new software product, you can email 50,000 interested people. Like, that's just massive, right? Like, I just can't overstate enough how important that is, you know, to the success of the business. And, you know, even with RankLogic, which is my newest WordPress plugin, I actually haven't even gotten around to, like, even creating an affiliate program or asking others to promote it yet. Like, I've just launched it to my own audience. It did great in the launch. And it continues to sell over the last couple of months, really just to my own audience. At some point, I'm going to finally get around to like reaching out to a bunch of people and saying, hey, do you want to promote this and that sort of thing. But if I didn't have an audience, I'd still be at $0 in sales, right?
I see it a lot, especially beginner entrepreneurs. Like they build a product first and then try to get demand after. And that's a lot harder. I mean, it's difficult because no one knows, likes, and trusts you.
Right. It is harder, but not impossible.
No, and not impossible.
I think it's a valuable sort of thought experiment or something to truly weigh the pros and cons of for somebody. If you're looking to launch a product, like if you have a great product idea, I would say build it right away, even if you don't have an audience. I wouldn't advise waiting to build that idea until right. you have an audience. Right. But it is much easier if you have an audience. Right. So if you do have an audience and you don't have a product idea, I would say, well, why not? You know, because you are so much further ahead of the game than somebody that doesn't have this audience. You know, somebody that doesn't have an audience, they could still do very well by just starting, you know, to build that audience on social media or just doing a lot of direct outreach. There are a lot of people that have huge audiences that you might be able to connect with. And all of a sudden you sort of skip that audience building, right? You can get in front of their audience and maybe right. be on their YouTube channel or their podcast or something, right? So there are ways to do well, even if you don't have an audience, but so much easier if you do.
Yeah. And I think that comes down to the like great debate of like how much product quality matters and how much the perception of quality is influenced by all the other stuff that's going on. Like, for example, you know, Logan Paul launches a water brand and it's insanely successful and it's all on the back of his audience. But like, is it yep. the best? Is it the best water? I don't know.
Probably not. It's just water, so, right?
Yeah. So
he's got something like, special in that water.
Right. And you can go down the list. I mean, The Rock, Conor McGregor, I mean, Kylie 100%. Jenner, like it's just, and they did it because they already had audience built and then they launched to that audience. And so the reverse is possible, like you mentioned as well. But it seems to be yeah. more challenging. I mean, they're both difficult, but it's just a matter of which one's more difficult, I guess.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Not yeah. having an audience is definitely more difficult. It's all about grabbing attention, right? The Kylie yeah. Jenner, the Logan Paul, The Rock, right? They've already got the attention. And so it makes sense. Like, I love that Mr. Beast is, you know, has a chocolate brand and is going to be moving into other products because he's got all this attention already. It's just a no-brainer for him to launch his products and to do that. So, that's something that people can, you know, think about as they kind of build their own business. You get these advertisers that the reason they spend so much money and a reason a lot of SEOs like us can make money on display ads or affiliate offers is because they don't have enough attention yet, right? They're trying to get more attention. They're right. paying these huge dollars so people can become aware of them. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it definitely shows, though, that the ability to build an audience is an extremely valuable skill because I mean, not everyone can do it, right? Because if every brand could just build an audience, then they wouldn't need to pay for advertising more than likely. It's not so simple.
Step one is start building that email list, right? If you got the SEO traffic coming in, that's awesome. Start getting a percentage of those to join your email list, because that really is your audience, right? Is when you can communicate with them directly.
For sure. Yeah. Would you mind just touching on that for a second? Because I think a lot of people who do SEO just think so much about inbound and think so much about just traffic. But like in my business, everything I think about is how can I get people on my email list? Because when I look at the numbers, most of my revenue comes from my email list. Like, it's pretty insane. When I really break it down, it's like wild how much it actually comes from there. So can you kind of go in on that a little bit, how important it is to build a list?
Yeah. And I'm the same way. Like, my email list is for sure one of my most valuable assets, right? My sales for Link Whisper, Rank Logic, those come from my email list, right? It's hard to quantify, really. Even if you've built an audience in other places, let's say you have an audience on YouTube, right? Let's say you have, 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. What percentage of those are actually going to watch your video, right? Even though, you can put a video in front of that, and that's good. I don't know what it is, 10%, 20% might actually of your subscribers actually watch your video. Right. That's awesome. That's really good, right? On Twitter, same thing. How much of your Twitter following is actually going to see your tweet? But your email list, right? You might have open rates of 40 or 50%, right? So half of those people are going to open and engage and read your email. So it's one of the most engaging, if not the most engaging, medium of where if you want to get something in front of your audience, like, that's where it's at. I mean, I can't stress enough like how critical that can be to launching your own products, to adding revenue to your business, just time and time again, right? Because it's not like you just email them once, you can email them every week, right? And it might be, of course, maybe not every week you're pushing your own products or something, you want to provide a lot of valuable content, but that's how they can get to know you. I just happen to feel like one of my strongest skills is writing. And that's why I started as a blogger. And so when I write my emails, I feel like I can communicate and connect well with people so that they feel like they do know me or trust me. And so I build that trust over a series of emails. And then I'm just totally honest with them and say, hey, here's what I do to build internal links. I use Link Whisper. Right. And so people are like, oh, Spencer uses it. I'm going to go check it out. So it's just, having an email list is just invaluable.
Yeah. And I one thing you mentioned, which I think is really an important nuance, is like on Twitter or on LinkedIn or on YouTube. Well, actually, mainly just Twitter and LinkedIn or like any social media, basically. I kind of put YouTube into a separate category. It's not really like social media to me, it's kind of like a separate entity. But like Twitter and LinkedIn, I mean, when you share a link, the algorithm destroys you. Right. So like, so that's not the case with email, right? You can put a link in an email and people will click it. And that is what we're trying to do as far as direct response. And so obviously on social media, you have to do a kind of like, it's a lot of indirect stuff, right? To get people there. And it still works. People will still find you, still come, maybe branded search, maybe they go to your profile, that can work. Yep. But man, nothing beats when you get, 10% CTR on an email link. I mean, that's some exciting stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, emails, they just see the headline, the email gets delivered, right? So if you have a great headline, it doesn't matter if you have a bunch of links in your email, it still gets delivered. Yeah. Somebody that does a good job about using all these other platforms that we mentioned and driving all of that to an email list is Sahil Bloom. He's on Twitter. He has a huge,
I've seen him.
I think that's where he started. Is on Twitter and he has a huge following that he's built there, but now he's actively driving people to his email list. Every once in a while he has an offer in his tweet or certainly in his bio. And now he has a huge email list And he's actually now spending money, you know, I don't know how much, $1, $2, $3 per subscriber. With all the money that he makes, he's essentially reinvesting to build his email list even more so that he sells more of his own products. And then he has more to invest in an email list. And now, you know, and all of this, I don't even know if he has a website. I'm sure he does, but like I don't think he's doing any SEO traffic or anything, right? So there's kind of a bunch of ways to skin the cat, you know, to go about it. But if you can always be thinking about building an audience, right? I think one of the strongest quivers you can have is SEO, like, and I would advise doing that. That's where I built most of my email list is from SEO. But yeah, but there's lots of others, right? If you're going to be on Twitter and YouTube and other places, like, get them back to your email list.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you too, because I've seen, so when I look at like, when I look at our data, I'll find that email is up there as far as one of the best traffic sources, but also the other one, which is a lot of people don't consider, is your existing customers. Right. And I've found that like, it's just, you know, business 101 that people who have purchased something from you in the past are more likely to purchase something from you in the future. So have you seen some kind of cross pollination between customers that, you know, buy multiple things from you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because now I have two WordPress plugins, for example, right? It's kind of interesting because I will have like my Niche Pursuits email list, of course, that I will email everybody. But then I can specifically also email my Link Whisper customers and say, hey, I know you love Link Whisper. It's a great WordPress plugin. You love it. You might also like this new one that I just created called Rank Logic, right? And so I can actually get more touch points for like customers that already purchased something. And those by far get the highest open rates, the highest click-through rates, and the highest buy rates. So yeah, you nailed it when you said somebody that's already bought one thing is the most likely candidate to buy another thing.
Right.
It's just the most valuable customer there is. They've already whipped out their credit card and spent. They're the type of person that might do it again.
Yeah. And I think the hardest thing to do in business is to take someone from that like marketing qualified lead, like someone who joins your email list, to get them to actually pull out their credit card and invest with you. That's kind of that first stage. But once that happens, once you've crossed that threshold and they see that you deliver good value, then, you know, they start to trust your brand. Right. So, so one thing I want, and we're running out of time, so I just want to ask you one thing, because I noticed that you were starting to amp up your YouTube strategy a little bit. I saw your video quality's gotten a lot better. I can tell there's a lot more production value. So how is that working out for you, and kind of what's your long-term plan on that front?
Yeah. YouTube is going well. So we've got lots of great interviews, and that's kind of been the core content. But more recently, I am doing some things that's going to result in even more interesting, sort of made for YouTube content, right? That involves my audience and other things going on. And so it's done really well. The YouTube channel has grown, and I see that it's a very active channel. You know, even though I use it as an example of like emails even better, which I think it is, YouTube is still very, very active and is a great place to build an audience. And I see that, I mean, it's, I hate to say the future is video, because I mean, the last 5 years have been video as well, but even more so, like, it's not going anywhere. So if you have a brand, it makes sense to be on YouTube. Just kind of where it's going is that I am going to be investing a lot more time and energy into YouTube. If 2022 was the year of growing my blog on Niche Pursuits, like, the end of 2023 and into 2024 is going to be a huge focus of growing my YouTube brand and trying to increase the subscribers and the traffic coming from that source.
Yeah. And if it gives you any encouragement, I'll tell you, my business, YouTube, is the best traffic source, like, hands down.
Awesome.
Like, even better than Google, which is pretty, it's hard for me to like make that statement knowing that I do SEO, but like when I look at it, YouTube is the king. So
yeah, no, it's interesting, because I did a video earlier in the year. If people want to watch it, it was, something titled, you know, I tried publishing 1,000 blog posts in a year, and here's
what
happened.
I saw that one. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. I did that earlier this year, and it's all about the story of, you know, kind of growing the traffic to Niche Pursuits. And that actually be a great video for people that are interested in SEO, just to learn the strategies that I followed. But I produced that video, and not only did it get, it has like 135,000 views, which is huge.
Very nice.
And the engagement was amazing. But I've got tons of email subscribers from it, because there I had a call out in the video for something. But I also sold a lot of Link Whisper directly from that YouTube video. I had a special coupon code that was only mentioned in that YouTube video. Mm. And a lot of people came and they bought, you know, after watching that video. And so, yes, the traffic can be extremely valuable. And I saw that. And that was a big part of why I've kicked off, like, oh, like there's real, you know, people really buying stuff from YouTube, and it can do really, really well. And so it's like, okay, that's kind of when the light bulb moment went on for me, was, you know, earlier this year. It's like, okay, I need to invest and do more, because it is a very engaged audience if you're putting in the effort and providing great content for them.
Yeah. And not to get too deep into the psychology of it, but I just think that there's a huge difference between someone reading an article versus watching a video, right? That's like
big time.
When someone is watching a video, the relationship that they feel that they're building with you is accelerated by 100%, compared to, you could be like, you're a great writer and like you could engage me well in a piece of content, but talking to you or feeling like you're talking to me is a totally different experience altogether. Yep. So I it's just my theory that it just accelerates that relationship of the, you know, the know, like, trust gets accelerated much faster, which then allows them to go deeper into your world. That's just my theory.
Yeah.
So
no, I agree. Yeah. I agree 100%. You know, being on video, there's, you know, if somebody's reading the transcript of this podcast, they don't see my facial expressions and all these, you know, other things that add nuance and add a lot of, you know, sort of data points that we as humans use to like know, oh, is this person telling the truth, or do I like this person? Can I trust this person? So I 100% agree.
Yeah. Well, awesome. So I'll let you go. We could talk all day, but where could people find you? We've already talked about fewer brands, but where's the best place they can go?
Yeah. Best place is on Niche Pursuits. So if they just go to nichepursuits.com, they can follow along everywhere. They can join my email list there, but I'm also on Twitter, at Niche Pursuits. And then finally on YouTube, if you just search up Niche Pursuits, you can see what's going on there as well.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. And we're definitely going to have to chat again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Nathan, it's been great. Appreciate chatting with you today as well.
Thank you so much.